Hello, and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the May 24 through 30 edition of The Economist. We'll begin, as usual, with The Leaders, a collection of six articles this week, chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first will be Exit Pursued by an Elephant. MAGA's assault on science is an act of grievous self-harm. Subheading, America will pay the price most of all. Second, Vietnam. The man with a plan for Vietnam. Subheading, a Communist Party hard man has to rescue Asia's great success story. Third, a big bailful bill. The Senate should vote down Donald Trump's reckless tax cuts. Subheading, if it does not, a collision with the bond markets awaits. Fourth, ever closer negotiation. The best part of the UK-EU deal is a system for doing more deals. Subheading, Sir Keir Starmer's reset is still a hard Brexit, and it will need softening. Fifth, Donald Trump's Golden Dome, the plan to protect America by shooting down missiles midair. It's not as outlandish as it sounds. And sixth, and finally, don't throw it away, how Poland can keep its place at the heart of Europe. If it turns inward, the country and continent will lose out. Following the reading of those six leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain. All, of course, as time allows. So, turning now to that first leader's article, and this is the cover story this week. The title is Exit, Pursued by an Elephant. MAGA's assault on science is an act of grievous self-harm. Subheading, America will pay the price most of all. The attacks have been fast and furious. In a matter of months, the Trump administration has canceled thousands of research grants and withheld billions of dollars from scientists. Projects at Harvard and Columbia, among the world's best universities, have been abruptly cut off. A proposed budget measure would slash as much as 50% from America's main research funding bodies. Because America's technological and scientific prowess is world-beating, the country has long been a magnet for talent. Now some of the world's brightest minds are anxiously looking for the exit. Why is the administration undermining its own scientific establishment? On May 19th, Michael Kratsios, a scientific advisor to President Donald Trump, laid out the logic. Science needs shaking up, he said, because it's become inefficient and sclerotic, and its practitioners have been captured by groupthink, especially on diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. You might find that reasonable enough, looking closely at what is happening. No, the picture's alarming. The assault on science is unfocused and disingenuous. Far from unshackling scientific endeavor, the administration is doing it grievous damage. The consequences will be bad for the world, but America will pay the biggest price of all. One problem is that actions are less targeted than the administration claims, as our special science section this week explains. As Mr. Trump's officials seek to stamp out DEI, punish universities for incidents of anti-Semitism, and cut overall government spending, science has become collateral damage. A suspicion that scientists are pushing woke thinking has led grantmakers to become allergic to words like trans and equity. As a consequence, it's not only inclusive education schemes that are being culled, but an array of orthodox science. Funding has been nixed for studies that seek, say, to assess cancer risk factors by race or the prevalence of sexually transmitted diseases by sex. The attack on elite universities takes this to an illogical extreme because the White House sees colleges as bastions of wokeness and anti-Semitism. It has withheld funding for research at Harvard and Columbia, no matter in which subject, Overnight projects on everything from Alzheimer's disease to quantum physics have been stopped. When scientists warn of the harm this does, they risk being seen as part of a scornful anti-MAGA elite that has been protected for too long. More fundamentally, the claim that Mr. Trump will stop groupthink is disingenuous. MAGA reserves a special hatred for public health and climate researchers, whom it finds as finger-wagging worrywarts determined to suppress Americans' liberties, as they did in lockdowns and school closures during COVID-19. The consequence is that spending on vaccine and climate research will be gutted most viciously of all. With the stroke of a pen, officials are trying to impose new rules that tell scientists what areas of inquiry they may pursue and what is off limits, a shocking step backwards for a republic founded on the free-thinking values of enlightenment. Meanwhile, genuine problems with the way science works in America are being neglected. Mr. Kratsios is right that there's too much bureaucracy. America's best researchers say they spend 2 out of 5 days on form filling and other administrative tasks instead of in the lab. Research is becoming more incremental. New ways of funding, such as lotteries, are worth trying. So far, however, the White House has not set out plans to make science work better. Indeed, when scientists are uncertain whether their work will still be funded, or if they take to the courts to challenge arbitrary grant terminations, American science becomes less efficient, not more so. Congress and the courts may yet act to limit the scale and scope of these anti-science endeavors. Even so, the damage of the past few months will soon be felt. Savage cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration mean worse weather forecasting, making it harder for farmers to know when to plant their crops, and for local authorities to prepare for natural disasters. Those to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will make it harder to monitor and thus curb outbreaks of disease. There will be longer-term harm, although Mr. Trump hopes his tariffs will lure businesses to invest in America. Their research spending is unlikely to fill the same gaps as publicly funded basic work, much of which may not be commercialized for years, if ever. As funding is frozen, the danger of a brain drain looms. In the first 3 months of the year, the number of applications for overseas jobs from American scientists rose by a third compared with the same period in 2024. Foreign researchers applying to come to America fell by a quarter. The country's reputation for welcoming talent will not be so easily regained if the belief that academic freedom is curtailed takes hold. The scientists who remain could self-censor their lines of inquiries for years to come. The consequences will be felt around the world. America is the planet's biggest backer of public research. It is home to half of all science Nobel laureates and 4 of the 10 best science research universities. The knowledge uncovered by American scientists and resulting innovations, such as the internet and mRNA vaccines, have been a boon to humanity. When America retreats, everyone is robbed of the fruits of this ingenuity. Exit, pursued by an elephant. It is America, however, that will feel the pain most of all. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was no branch of science in which Uncle Sam led the world. At the century's end, there was nowhere where it did not. America's triumphs, its economic prowess, and its technical and military might were interwoven with that scientific success. As America pulls back, it will cede ground to authoritarian China as a scientific superpower with all the benefits that confers. MAGA's assault on science is not just about DEI, nor is it about universities. It is first and foremost an act of self-harm. And our second leader's article is titled, Vietnam, the man with a plan for Vietnam. Subheading, a Communist Party hard man has to rescue Asia's greatest success story. 50 years ago, the last Americans were evacuated from Saigon, leaving behind a war-ravaged and impoverished country. Today, Saigon, renamed Ho Chi Minh City, is a metropolis of over 9 million people full of skyscrapers and flashy brands. You might think this is the moment to celebrate Vietnam's triumph, its elimination of severe poverty, its ranking as one of the top 10 exporters to America, its role as a manufacturing hub for firms like Apple and Samsung. In fact, Vietnam has trouble in store to avoid it and show whether emerging economies can still join the developed world. Vietnam will have to pull off a second miracle. It must find new ways to get rich despite the trade war, and the hard man in charge must turn himself into a reformer. That man, to Lem, isn't exactly Margaret Thatcher. He emerged to become the Communist Party boss from the security state last year after a power struggle. He nonetheless recognizes that his country's formula is about to stop working. It was concocted in the 1980s in the Doi Mui reforms that opened up the economy to trade and private firms. These changes, plus cheap labor and political stability, turned Vietnam into an alternative to China. The country has attracted $230 billion of multinational investment and become an electronics assembly titan. Chinese, Japanese, South Korean, and Western firms all operate factories there. In the past decade, Vietnam has grown at a compound annual rate of 6%, faster than India and China. The immediate problem is the trade war. Vietnam is so good at exporting that it is now the fifth biggest trade surplus with America. President Donald Trump's threat of a 46% levy might be negotiated down. Vietnam craftily offered the administration a grab bag of goodies to please the president and his allies, including a deal for SpaceX and the purchase of Boeing aircraft. On May 21st, Eric Trump, the president's son, broke ground at a Trump resort in Vietnam, which he said would blow everyone away. But even a reduced tariff rate would be a nightmare for Vietnam. It has already lost competitiveness as factory wages have risen above those in India, Indonesia, and Thailand. And if, as the price of a deal, America presses Vietnam to purge its economy of Chinese inputs, technology, and capital, that will upset the delicate geopolitical balancing act it has performed so well. Like many Asian countries, it wants to hedge between an unreliable America and a bullying China, which, despite being a fellow communist state, has long been a rival and now disputes Vietnam's claim to coastal waters and atolls. The trade and geopolitical crunch is happening as the population is aging and amid rising environmental harm, from thinning topsoils in the Mekong Delta to coal-choked air. Mr. Lam made his name orchestrating a corruption purge called the Blazing Furnace. Now he has to torch Vietnam's old economic model. He has set expectations sky high by declaring an era of national rise, that's in quotes, and targeting double-digit growth by 2030. He has made flashy announcements too, including quadrupling the science and technology budget and setting a target to earn $100 billion a year from semiconductors by 2050. But to avoid stagnation, Mr. Lam needs to go further, confronting entrenched problems that other developing countries also face as the strategy of exporting to get rich becomes trickier. Vietnam's growth miracle is concentrated around a few islands of modernity. Big multinational companies run giant factories for export that employ locals, but they mostly buy their inputs abroad and create few spillovers for the rest of the economy. That's why Vietnam has failed to increase the share of the value in its exports that is added inside the country. A handful of politically connected conglomerates dominate property and banking, among other industries. None is yet globally competitive, including Vietnam's loss-making Tesla wannabe, VinFast, which is part of the biggest conglomerate, Vingroup. Meanwhile, clumsy state-owned enterprises still run industries from energy to telecoms. To spread prosperity, Mr. Lam needs to level the playing field for smaller firms and new entrants. That means hacking back a bewildering licensing regime and allowing credit to flow to small firms by shaking up a corruption-prone banking industry. Legislation issued this month abolishes a tax on household firms and strengthens the legal protection for entrepreneurs. That's a step in the right direction, but Mr. Lam also needs to free up universities so that ideas flow more easily and innovations thrive. This is where it gets risky. Vietnam's people would, without a doubt, benefit from a more liberal political system, but although that may also help development, China has shown it may not be essential, at least not immediately. What's crucial is facing down powerful vested interests that hog scarce resources. A good start would be forcing the oligarchs to compete internationally or lose state support, as South Korea did with its kaibols. Often they are protected by cronies and pals within the state apparatus and the Communist Party. Encouragingly, Mr. Lam has already begun a high-stakes streamlining of the state, including by laying off 100,000 civil servants. He's also halving the number of provinces in the country where regions have sponsored powerful factions within the party. And he is abolishing several ministries. All this will modernize the bureaucracy, but it's also a brilliant way of making enemies. The autocrat's dilemma. The danger is that, like Xi Jinping in China, Mr. Lam centralizes power so as to renew the system, but in the process perpetuates a culture of fear and deference that undermine his reforms. If Mr. Lam fails, Vietnam will muddle on as a low value-added production center that misses its moment. But if he succeeds, a second Doi Mo would propel 100 million Vietnamese into the developed world, creating another Asian growth engine and making it less likely that Vietnam will fall into a Chinese sphere of influence. This is Vietnam's last best chance to become rich before it gets old. Its destiny rests with Mr. Lam, Asia's least likely but most consequential reformer. America has more fiscal leeway than other countries, but the Republican Party seems determined to test its limits. Net federal debts have grown to 100% of GDP, a near trebling over two decades, meaning that the Treasury will soon pay more than $1 trillion per year in debt interest, almost as much as it spends on health care for the old. Politicians who should be debating how to tighten their belts are instead poised to raise borrowing still further, unless they think again they risk stoking a crisis. Some Republicans pretend their budgeting's sound, but they're guilty of a sleight of hand. The bill's main effect is to take the temporary tax cuts from Mr. Trump's first term and make them permanent. A continuation of the status quo, they argue, is not a new expense. The bill also adds new tax cuts, which, to keep down costs, will supposedly expire in 2028. In other words, sunset clauses for new tax cuts seem to count as a savings, but stopping scheduled sunsets comes for free. To this fantasy, the bill adds cuts to clean energy subsidies and Medicaid, health insurance mostly for the poor, to produce a slight fiscal tightening. In reality, the bill makes it more likely America will exhaust its fiscal space. Today's official forecast, which suggests that net debt interest could soon hit a record high as share of GDP and then keep rising, are bleak, and they assume that the 2017 tax cuts expire and that deficits will narrow. The new law would ensure that deficits stay around 6-7% of GDP, raising forecast debt in 2034 by about $3 trillion. And if new temporary tax cuts become permanent, the cost could exceed $4 trillion. These measures include tax exemptions for tips and overtime pay that were promised by Mr. Trump during his election campaign. Once enacted, they'll be hard to get rid of, whatever the law says. Republicans hope that two things will fill this giant hole. One is tariff revenues. This may be partly true, but their estimated proceeds range from $1.4 trillion to $2.9 trillion over a decade. Furthermore, the figures include reciprocal duties that are on hold, pending talks to reduce them after their announcement, and that caused a mini run on dollar assets. The other great Republican hope is economic growth. Yet today's bill is far less pro-growth than Mr. Trump's past tax reforms, which included a permanent, big corporate tax cut. The tip and overtime exemptions are gimmicks. The bill even includes a big increase in the deduction that high earners can claim on account of their state and local tax bills, which in effect subsidizes lower levels of government to raise the taxes that they level. When combined with Mr. Trump's tariffs, the overall effect on growth will be negative. Moreover, whereas in 2017 a deficit increase arguably provided a helpful stimulus, there's less slack in the economy today, meaning that more spending is likely to be offset by higher interest rates. Junky debt. The bill now passes to the Senate, which should vote against it. The belief that deficits will never matter is dangerous, especially as doubts mount over the country's commitment to economic stability and low inflation under Mr. Trump. America needs lower spending and higher taxes to bring down borrowing. When politicians do not face up to reality, the bond market eventually forces reality upon them, and that could prove sudden and painful. And our fourth leader's article is titled Ever Closer Negotiation. The best part of the UK-EU deal is a system for doing more deals. And the subheading, Keir Starmer's reset is still a hard Brexit, and it will need softening. Fans and foes of this week's agreement between Britain and the European Union have made hugely exaggerated claims about it. Keir Starmer heralded it as historic and the start of a new era. The Prime Minister's opponents accused him of betraying Brexit or of killing it altogether. The truth is that the deal sensibly, if modestly, reduces some of the worst trade frictions introduced after Britain's exit from the EU 5 years ago, and it adds a new pact to work together on rebuilding Europe's defenses, an urgent task given Russian aggression and American equivocation. But this reset is neither historic nor an act of betrayal. Britain remains hard. That's in quotation marks, hard. Alongside defense, the main agreement was for Britain to align with EU food standards, thereby easing frictions that have hit exports hard. Linking carbon adjustment and electricity schemes will also help trade. A planned youth mobility program should benefit both sides, as will Britain's promise to consider rejoining the Erasmus Plus student exchange scheme. The same goes for closer cooperation on data exchange through the Europol policing agency. Sir Keir reckons the overall passage may boost Britain's economy by about £9 billion, $12 billion, in 2040. That's only 0.3% of GDP, but for a sluggish economy, it's still welcome. This being a trade negotiation, both sides may make concessions. Sir Keir rolled over the EU's access to British fishing waters for 12 extra years to 2038, outraging many fishermen. His alignment with EU food regulations means accepting rules which Britain has very little say in making, and some role for the European Court of Justice. Against this, aligning with food rules simplifies trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and Britain retains the freedom to strike trade deals with third countries, as it has just done with America and India. The claim by Kemi Badenoch, leader of the Conservatives, that this is a sellout is absurd. Sir Keir has stuck to all three red lines that Labour put in its party manifesto last year. No single market, no customs union, and no free movement of people. Indeed, for most of the period after 2016, when Britain voted to leave the EU, this version of Brexit would have been deemed to be hard, not soft. Voters were sold a vision in which swashbuckling post-Brexit Britain would be global and deregulated at the same time as it set its own rules to control trade and immigration. Acknowledging this outcome was always a fantasy is not a betrayal, but the welcome intrusion of reality. Ms. Badenoch is also ignoring a shift in public opinion. Most voters now think the vote to leave was a mistake. A majority, even in Nigel Farage's Reform UK, favor closer relations with Brussels, and so do most business groups. EU leaders seem pleased, not because they think they've won a battle, but because they want closer relations with an important partner. This is clearest in defense, since building a credible European system of security requires not just more money, but also the full participation of one of the continent's military powers. Warmer relations also increase the chances of further improvements in the Brexit deal. So what next? This week's agreement is really a roadmap to a deal. Years of negotiations now lie ahead. Perhaps its best feature was to establish a system of annual summits with working parties implementing future details. This framework could eventually even lead to a re-examination of Sir Keir's red lines. A future government may have a mandate to trade off sovereignty against membership of the customs union. The direction of travel towards a closer relationship is now set. Other countries in Europe that are not members of the EU are working their way along a similar course. Norway is starting a new debate about joining the club. The Swiss have spent over 30 years negotiating every detail of their relationship. Post-Brexit Britain must get used to that, too. And as we approach the halfway mark in today's broadcast, we remind you, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we are reading today from the May 24 through 30 edition of The Economist. So, turning now to the fifth of six leaders' articles, we have the title, Donald Trump's Golden Dome, The Plan to Protect America by Shooting Down Missiles Mid-Air. Subheading, It's Not as Outlandish as It Sounds. In the 1980s, scientists working on Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative proposed what seemed like a madcap scheme to defend America. Thousands of interceptor satellites would orbit Earth and attack enemy missiles as they took off. The idea fizzled out. It has been resuscitated by Donald Trump, who on May 20th said his Golden Dome missile defense shield would cost $175 billion in total, take 2 to 3 years to complete, and offer close to 100% protection. Mr. Trump's vision sounds just as fantastical as Reagan's. Quote, we call it super technology. Nobody else has it, end quote. But in essence, the Golden Dome is not as outlandish as it might once have been. In fact, done well, it could become a useful part of America's defensive arsenal. In the 1980s, putting sensors into space and building miniature computers to sit inside thousands of interceptors was very expensive. Now, thanks in part to Elon Musk and his company SpaceX, launch costs have fallen dramatically. The Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, an ostensibly nonpartisan think tank, estimates that the cost of developing a constellation that could defeat 1 to 2 intercontinental range ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, has fallen by 30% to 40% with estimates in 2004 and 2012. The Golden Dome idea also promises to be more useful, which is why the Biden administration began work on the space-based sensors that would track cruise missiles and the digital pipes that pass tracking data from satellite to satellite. America's adversaries increasingly wield missiles that can take more circuitous routes to the continental United States, circumventing the radars and interceptors designed for attacks coming over the polar region. In addition, the threat to America used to come solely from nuclear-armed missiles. It now includes non-nuclear conventional missiles that might target ports, air bases, or other military infrastructure. Inevitably, Mr. Trump's claims are exaggerated. No missile defense system will ever offer blanket protection. America would need 36,000 space-based interceptors to defeat just 10 North Korean ICBMs, allowing for 30 seconds of decision time, according to the American Physical Society, a group of physicists. Countering larger salvos from Russia and China and covering every corner of American soil would cause those numbers to mushroom. So too would the cost. Even a modest shield designed to parry a couple of ICBMs could cost $161 to $542 billion over 20 years. That's an enormous sum, at a time when the modernization of nuclear forces is also expected to demand $946 billion by 2035. In practice, Mr. Trump should be more modest in his ambitions, and not only because of the cost. In his executive order in January, he demanded a system that could defend against any foreign aerial attack. In his announcement this week, he promised that cruise, ballistic, and hypersonic missiles would all be destroyed. If so, it would be destabilizing, fearing that their nuclear deterrent forces might become effective. China, or rather ineffective, China and Russia would seek to expand their arsenals, in China's case even faster than today, or to build weapons that give American leaders even less warning time. In reality, some Russian and Chinese nuclear-armed ICBMs would always get through. However, that does not mean homeland missile defense is pointless. In recent years, Israel, Ukraine, and India have all shown how blocking even a modest share of incoming projectiles can limit damage and buy some decision-making time for political leaders, who might otherwise feel compelled to fire back at once. And our sixth and final leader's article today is titled, Don't Throw It Away, How Poland Can Keep Its Place at the Heart of Europe. Subheading, If It Turns Inward, the Country and Continent Will Lose Out. Twice, it vanished from the map, swallowed up by its rapacious neighbors. After it emerged from the Second World War as a Soviet satellite, it endured decades of oppression. Today, Poland has transformed itself into Europe's most overlooked military and economic power, with a bigger army than Britain, France, or Germany, and living standards adjusted for purchasing power that are about to eclipse Japan's. Yet, just when Poland should stand proud and tall once more, is it about to throw away its influence? That is the question Poles face in the decisive runoff vote to elect their president June 1st. One vision from the candidate of Law and Justice Party is a brand of right-wing nationalism that feeds off conflict with Poland's neighbors in the European Union. The other, from the center, is that, in a dangerous world, Poland needs Europe to magnify its strength, just as Europe needs Poland as a sort of security and economic dynamism. Unfortunately, at the moment, the right may have the upper hand. In the past three decades, Poland has shown how much a country can achieve by European integration and good economic policy. Since 1995, income per person has more than trebled. Since it joined the EU in 2004, Poland has never known recession, apart from briefly at the height of the COVID-19 shutdown. During those two decades, its average annual growth has been almost 4%. The fruits of that growth are on display across the country. Warsaw, the capital, boasts Europe's tallest building outside Russia, the Varsovie Tower, and below it bustles with designer shops and cafes, IT startups, and fashion houses. Out in the once neglected countryside, fine roads, often built with EU money, crisscross vistas of well-tended fields, farms, and new houses. Poles used to flock abroad to find work, but for some years now, home has been a stronger draw. Manufacturing is booming thanks to Poland's proximity to Germany, continuing to do well even as its western neighbor, much like of Europe, has stagnated. When Germany, under its new chancellor, Friedrich Merz, starts a planned new burst of infrastructure and defense spending, Poland is likely to be a beneficiary. Long attuned to the threat from Russia, Poland has used its wealth to enhance its security. It now musters the largest army in Europe after Russia, Ukraine, and Turkey, and the third largest in NATO. It spends well over 4% of its GDP each year on defense, far above the 2% that has been the NATO target since 2014, and plans to raise that to 5% next year. This has translated into influence. These days, the group that counts in European security is sometimes dubbed the Four Musketeers. The young addition to Britain, France, and Germany is Poland, like the superlative swordsman of D'Artagnan. Tellingly, its Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, traveled to Kyiv earlier this month with his three counterparts to stressed that Europe is ready to stand by Ukraine, even as America's commitment has weakened. Poland's stance is in sharp distinction to the rest of the Visegrad Four. Hungary under Viktor Orban and Slovakia under Robert Fico have both taken the side of Russia rather than Ukraine, and the Czech Republic is expected to tilt in that direction after elections come in October. Given Poland's record, much of it achieved during the total of 10 years in which PiS has been in power, you might conclude that it could continue its renaissance with either candidate in June's runoff election, especially as the role of president in Poland is less powerful than that of prime minister. However, that would be a mistake. Under the Constitution, the president's veto can be overridden only by a 3/5 majority in the Sejm, the lower house, in which Mr. Tusk does not command. The current president, Andrzej Duda, is a former PiS politician who has blocked or delayed many of the new government's reforms and is now termed out. PiS wants his successor to be Karol Nawrocki, a fierce ideologue who would be even less accommodating than Mr. Duda. Mr. Nawrocki is almost certain to use his powers to block Mr. Tusk's agenda, so as to pave the way for a PiS victory in the next parliamentary elections. To win the presidency, he would depend on support from far-right parties that exploit growing anti-Ukrainian feelings. One of those is openly anti-Semitic. This matters because Mr. Tusk is trying to unravel PiS's capture of the state while it was most recently in office from 2015 to 2023. In that time, while pursuing mostly sensible economic and security policies, PiS systematically took over independent institutions, including the judiciary, the media, the civil service, and the banking system. PiS's fights with Brussels over the rule of law caused Poland to be temporarily shut out of some of the EU's aid programs. By contrast, Mr. Tusk is a committed European. He previously served as the president of the European Council in Brussels. Under him, Poland has cooperated with other European countries on security, diplomacy, and defense to the benefit of all. Were Poles to use the presidential election to vote in Rafał Trzaskowski, a Tusk ally who is Warsaw's mayor, EU cooperation would be easier and Poland's influence would grow further. The world has changed since Mr. Tusk took over. With another Donald back in the White House, the task of building up Europe's strategic autonomy is not just a luxury, but an urgent necessity. Poland could not only set an example in security, but also serve as a powerful voice for supporting Ukraine and deterring Russia. Economically, Poland is an example to Central and Eastern European countries, and Mr. Tusk could be a proponent of the economic reforms the EU desperately needs. Don't throw it away. Next week's election is finely balanced. In the first round, the candidates of the hard right took around 52% of the vote. Were Mr. Nawrocki, or perhaps it's Nawrocki, to win the second round, both Poland and Europe would suffer. Europe would lose a source of dynamism, and Poland would risk losing the place at the heart of Europe it has worked so hard to claim. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin as usual with an article from the section on the United States. This one is titled Reduction Redux. What happens if the Inflation Reduction Act goes away? Subheading: Evaluating the effects of scrapping green subsidies in Washington. It'll be somewhere between a scalpel and a sledgehammer, was how Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, described the emerging Republican approach to the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, Joe Biden's signature climate law. Pressure from companies and congressmen with clean energy products benefiting from its subsidies in their districts, and most are found in Republican counties, suggested surgical precision would prevail. But relentless pressure to abolish the IRA from the president, who was a fan of Drilling Baby Drilling and denounced the law as the Green New Scam, pointed instead to brute force. The president reinforced this by dropping in on a private party caucus on May 20th to strong-arm waverers and threaten dissenters with a MAGA primary challenge. Quote, "They won't be Republicans much longer. They'd be knocked out so fast," end quote. So declared President Trump. The House Ways and Means Committee has already approved a draft law that, when it comes to the IRA, looks more like a sledgehammer. A bill resembling it could be passed by the full House before long. Then the Senate will get to work on its proposal. The two versions will then be reconciled by committee. The White House wants the compromise deal ready by July 4th, though August seems more realistic. A collapse of the whole effort remains possible, too. All this sausage-making raises two questions for energy policy. Is the IRA dead? And if it is, will that end America's clean energy boom and herald a sooty recarbonization of the economy? At first glance, the bill seems more scalpel-like. The House proposal phases out renewable subsidies between 2029 and 2032, in line with the IRA's original timeline. It includes seemingly innocuous rules on which institutions are eligible for tax credits and keeping China out of the energy supply chain. The original law aimed to make clean energy politically popular in America by subsidizing domestic manufacturing of solar panels, wind turbines, and other components. Voters might not prioritize reducing carbon emissions, the theory went, but they do like domestic manufacturing. There ought to be some overlap with the new orthodoxy on economics. Because the cost of tax credits depends on private investment plans, estimates of the bill's effect come in a range rather than a dollar amount. The American Action Forum, a conservative think tank, reckons the bill would trim about 60% of the IRA's tax credits, saving $515 billion by 2034. The Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, which previously warned that the IRA's uncapped provisions could cost $4.7 trillion by 2050, has called the Republican effort too timid. That makes it sound as if it falls short of the president's aim to kill the IRA. Look closer, though, and the proposal brims with rules designed to stifle clean energy. Quote, "It's a sledgehammer masquerading as a scalpel," end quote. So says Abigail Ross Hopper, head of the Solar Energy Industries Association, a lobby group. Wood Mackenzie, an energy consultancy, argues that the details will undermine the business case for, quote, "the vast majority of clean energy projects in the United States," end quote. Three provisions in particular stand out. First, the bill kills what is called transferability. The IRA incentivized companies with a wide range of tax liabilities to invest in clean energy. The new bill eliminates the sweetener even for technologies like nuclear power and carbon capture that are generally favored by Republicans. Second, provisions regarding foreign entities of concern, meaning China, are written with calculated vagueness, while Biden-era rules narrowly restricted imports of Chinese battery cells. The new legislation is at once sweeping and impenetrable. Credits appear denied if, quote, "any component, subcomponent, or applicable critical mineral is extracted, processed, recycled, manufactured, or assembled," that's all in quotes, "with forbidden foreign connections." Various such provisions guarantee years of regulatory confusion. Higher tariffs on Chinese-made components would come on top of that. The third change is the timing of payments. Currently, projects qualify for tax credits from when construction begins, but earn them only when operational. The new proposal awards credits only after operations begin. Given the vagaries of permit granting, it can take years to start generating power, and that will make it harder for new projects to earn credits. Together, these provisions make the House proposal unworkable, says Rich Powell, head of the Clean Energy Buying Association, CEBA, a trade group representing large electricity users, which include America's big tech companies. Studies commissioned by CEBA predict that the repeal effort will lead to sharp increases in electricity prices by roughly 10% in 2026 for industrial and commercial customers. Mr. Powell warns that it will make it harder to stand up U.S. manufacturing and clean energy, which ought to bother a president obsessed with factory jobs. If the outlook for the IRA seems bleak, what does that mean for energy and carbon emissions in America? Analysis by the Rhodium Group, a research firm, suggests that under the IRA, America was on track to slash its greenhouse gases by 40% from their 2005 level by 2035. With a de facto repeal, it will slow down but may still manage a reduction of nearly 30% below the same benchmark. Even taking account of oil-friendly provisions in the current budget bill, such as the end of credits for purchasing electric vehicles and a repeal of more stringent fuel economy standards for petrol vehicles introduced by the Biden administration, America will continue to decarbonize. Clean energy supply will continue to grow, but at a slower pace than it would have with the IRA. The reason, explains Kevin Book of Clearview Energy Partners, a research firm, is that tax credits are only one factor. State-level regulations like renewable portfolio standards play an important role. Not only will these not be abandoned with the IRA, they may be strengthened in Democratic states. Such a rollback rebound took place in response to the first Trump administration's attempted assault on green energy. Price helps too. The International Energy Agency, an official body, estimates that unsubsidized renewables already compete with or beat new fossil fuel plants in many parts of America. Rhodium projects 342 gigawatts of renewable capacity will still be added by 2035, producing as much electricity, after accounting for intermittency, as roughly 100 nuclear plants. John Ketchum, the CEO of NextEra Energy, a big utility, recently offered investors this dose of what he calls energy pragmatism. Quote, renewables are here today. You can build a wind project in 12 months, a storage facility in 15, and a solar project in 18 months. Gas turbines, by contrast, require 4 years or more to build, obtain permits, and connect to the grid. Last year, 90% of new power capacity in America came from carbon-free sources. Fresh data from the early days of Mr. Trump's second term confirm that over half of all electricity in March came from non-fossil sources for the first month on record. These may be dark days for green energy on Capitol Hill. Slowing the rate of decarbonization is bad news, but sunlit uplands do still beckon. And turning next to the section on the Americas, we have an article titled Argentina Economic Reform. An election win boosts Javier Milei's reform project. The subheading, lower inflation brings popularity. Popularity brings power, which helps with lowering inflation. In most of the world, midterm elections for half of the seats in a city hall would be ignored by presidents and markets alike. Not so in Argentina. Javier Milei, the libertarian president, made his spokesperson his party's leading candidate in elections held May 18th in Buenos Aires. He cast the capital's ballot as a referendum on his government. His party won 30% of the vote, compared with 27% for the leftist Peronists and 16% for the center-right PRO, the party of a former president, Mauricio Macri. Argentine shares soared in response and sovereign bonds rose. Having beaten Mr. Macri in his stronghold, Mr. Milei intends to sideline him entirely, trying to subsume the PRO ahead of national midterms in October. Argentine politics have been in flux since Mr. Milei won the presidential election race in late 2023, running as an angry outsider. He has slashed spending and brought raging inflation sharply down. In April, he partially floated the peso. Yet Argentina has a history of woeful economic policy, and Mr. Milei's steps are not enough. A reformer also has to show repeatedly he can keep the Peronists out. A struggling government and resurgent Peronists, even in minor elections, can spook markets and send the economy spiraling. This week's win is a boost, though despite compulsory voting, turnout was at a historically low 53%. Two conclusions emerge. One is that politicians, or rather politics, will probably get angrier and dirtier. Mr. Milei's style is to rage against perceived enemies, and the press is now a prime target. Quote, people don't hate journalists enough, end quote. That's his new catchphrase. Mr. Milei also made his spokesperson the lead candidate, while keeping him in post and giving him juicy announcements close to the election. More worrying was a fake video generated using artificial intelligence, purporting to show Mr. Macri urging people to vote for Mr. Milei's party in order to block the Peronists. It was shared on election eve by social media accounts close to the president, including one widely reported to belong to his powerful spin doctor. The second is that the government will continue to think that bringing inflation down is the path to electoral success and will bet everything to that end. That is why, after allowing the peso to float within a band prompted in part by the IMF, the government has done all it can to keep the peso strong, avoiding a depreciation that would push inflation up. Interest rates remain high, while the government has tweaked rules to encourage foreigners to convert dollars into pesos in order to profit from a form of carry trade. A temporary tax break is pushing the soybean exporters to sell their harvest fast, also boosting the peso. The central bank has declared it will not buy dollars to rebuild its reserves until the peso touches its limit of 1,000 to the dollar, and it has allegedly fiddled in the futures market to strengthen it. To the same end, the government is expected to announce a loosening of rules on tax evasion, encouraging Argentines to bring an estimated $270 billion hidden in mattresses back into the formal economy. The approach is working, for now. Post-float depreciation was modest. Monthly inflation fell to 2.8% in April. Mr. Milei may benefit from a flywheel effect, whereby markets cheer his victory, which in turn boosts sovereign bonds and confidence in the peso, further staving off an inflationary depreciation. If inflation keeps falling, he could win handsomely in October. But flywheels can break down. The peso remains very strong and so vulnerable to a depreciation, especially once the harvest ends in July. Mr. Milei surely hopes to delay any reckoning until after the midterms. Boosting the peso makes exports less competitive. The central bank's refusal to buy dollars to rebuild net reserves comes as it needs $5 billion or so by mid-June in order to meet the demands of IMF's new program. It's preparing to borrow to do so, but that only delays the problem. The other risk is that the Peronists, who increase their seat share in Buenos Aires, do well in the midterms, and that could spook people into dumping the peso, thus prompting inflation. For now, such worries have not punctured Mr. Milei's euphoria. And turning to the section on Middle East and Africa, we have an article titled Gaza on the Brink Again. Israel says it's unleashing a, quote, unprecedented attack. And the subheading is More War Beckons as Donald Trump Freezes Out Benjamin Netanyahu. In a career of many crises, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, faces a defining moment. The path he chooses may alter Israel's relationship with the Palestinians and America, its closest ally. One route involves reinvading Gaza to try to eradicate Hamas, which the Israeli Defense Forces are poised to do. That would cause more casualties and further damage Mr. Netanyahu's relationships with America, and the Gulf states would suffer. The other path would involve a truce that could topple Mr. Netanyahu's government, repair Israel's influence in the White House at a time when Mr. Trump is reinventing American policy toward the Gulf, Syria, and Iran. The implications of that shift could last decades. The odds of the first path reinvasion are now dangerously high. On May 19th, Mr. Netanyahu said the IDF would be taking control of all of Gaza. Those are his words. His finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, a leader of one of the coalition's far-right parties, went even further. Quote, "We are destroying what is still left of the Strip simply because everything there is one big city of terror," end quote. The IDF has warned Gazans to leave Khan Yunis, a key city, ahead of an unprecedented attack. Israel hopes a final surge will eradicate what remains of Hamas. On May 13th, a strike may have killed Mohammed Sinwar, one of its last senior commanders. The humanitarian cost is likely to be staggering. Since the collapse of a ceasefire March 18th, perhaps 5,000 Gazans have been killed, taking the total to over 50,000, including combatants. Hunger is widespread. In preparation for a ground attack, the IDF has been conducting over 100 strikes a day. The probable death of Mr. Sinwar may also help bring a ceasefire with another hardliner out of the way. Hamas's more pragmatic political leaders, who are based outside Gaza, may have more leeway. Still, the main obstacles to peace remain. Israel will countenance only a temporary truce, during which more of the hostages would be freed and more aid allowed in. But Hamas has ruled out any deal unless it permanently ends the war and is balking at Israel's demand that it disarm and send its surviving Gazan leaders into exile. Pressure is increasing on both sides. The majority of members of the EU want the chance to re-examine Israel's free trade agreement with Europe, its main trading partner. Britain has suspended talks on a new trade deal. A majority of Israelis favor ending the war. Yair Golan, the leader of the opposition Democrats, warned Israel could become a pariah state. A sane country does not wage war against civilians, does not kill babies as a pastime, and does not engage in mass population displacement. And Hamas is under pressure too, as its people starve. In polls, around half of Gazans say they would leave given the chance. Perhaps there will be a last-minute compromise. Without it, the future looks bleak. Mr. Netanyahu says he will end the war only once he has won total victory. The total devastation of Gaza and isolation for Israel look more likely. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the May 24 through 30 edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.